Thou dost not care. Third person singular, she does not care, returned Tom.
Good, very quaint, said his friend. Though you don't mean it.
But I do mean it, cried Tom, upon my honour. Why, you won't tell me, Mr. Harthouse, that you really suppose my sister Lou does care for old Bounderby.
My dear fellow, returned the other, what am I bound to suppose when I find two married people living in harmony and happiness?
Tom had by this time got both his legs on the sofa. If his second leg had not been already there when he was called a dear fellow, he would have put it up at that great stage of the conversation. Feeling it necessary to do something, then, he stretched himself out at greater length, and reclining with the back of his head on the end of the sofa, and smoking with an infinite assumption of negligence, turned his common face and not too sober eyes towards the face looking down upon him so carelessly, yet so potently.
"You know our governor, Mr. Harthouse," said Tom, "and therefore you needn't be surprised that Lou married old Bounderby. She never had a lover, and the governor proposed old Bounderby, and she took him."
"Very dutiful in your interesting sister," said Mr. James Harthouse. "Yes, but she wouldn't have been as dutiful, and it would not have come off as easily," returned the whelp, "if it hadn't been for me."
The tempter merely lifted his eyebrows, but the whelp was obliged to go on.
"I persuaded her," he said, with an edifying air of superiority. "I was stuck into old Bounderby's bank where I never wanted to be, and I knew I should get into scrapes there if she put old Bounderby's pipe out, so I told her my wishes and she came into them. She would do anything for me. It was very game of her, wasn't it?"
"It was charming, Tom."
"Not that it was altogether so important to her as it was to me," continued Tom, coolly, "because my liberty and comfort, and perhaps my getting on, depended on it, and she had no other lover, and staying at home was like staying in jail, especially when I was gone. It wasn't as if she gave up another lover for old Bounderby. But still it was a good thing in her.
Perfectly delightful. And she gets on so placidly."
"Oh," returned Tom with contemptuous patronage, "she's a regular girl. A girl can get on anywhere. She has settled down to the life, and she don't mind. It does just as well as another. Besides, though Lou is a girl, she's not a common sort of girl. She can shut herself up within herself and think, as I've often known her sit and watch the fire, for an hour at a stretch."
"Aye, aye. Has resources of her own," said Harthouse, smoking quietly.
"Not so much of that as you may suppose," returned Tom.
"For our governor had her crammed with all sorts of dry bones and sawdust. It's his system."
"Formed his daughter on his own model," suggested Harthouse. "His daughter? Aye, and everybody else. Why, he formed me that way," said Tom.
"Impossible."
"He did, though," said Tom, shaking his head. "I mean to say, Mr. Harthouse, that when I first left home and went to old Bounderby's, I was as flat as a warming pan, and knew no more about life than any oyster does."
"Come, Tom, I can hardly believe that. A joke's a joke."
"Upon my soul," said the whelp, "I am serious, I am indeed." He smoked with great gravity and dignity for a little while, and then added in a highly complacent tone, "Oh, I've picked up a little since, I don't deny that, but I've done it myself, no thanks to the governor."
"And your intelligent sister?"
"My intelligent sister is about where she was. She used to complain to me that she had nothing to fall back upon that girls usually fall back upon, and I don't see how she is to have got over that since. But she don't mind," he sagaciously added, puffing at his cigar again. "Girls can always get on somehow."
Calling at the bank yesterday evening for Mr. Bounderby's address, I found an ancient lady there who seems to entertain great admiration for your sister, observed Mr. James Harthouse, throwing away the last small remnant of the cigar he had now smoked out.
"Mother Sparsit," said Tom. "What, you've seen her already, have you?"
His friend nodded. Tom took his cigar out of his mouth to shut up his eye, which had grown rather unmanageable with the greater expression, and to tap his nose several times with his finger.
"Mother Sparsit's feeling for Lou is more than admiration, I should think," said Tom. "Say affection and devotion. Mother Sparsit never set her cap at Bounderby when he was a bachelor. Oh, no."
These were the last words spoken by the whelp, before a giddy drowsiness came upon him, followed by complete oblivion. He was roused from the latter state by an uneasy dream of being stirred up with a boot, and also of a voice saying, "Come, it's late, be off."
"Well," he said, scrambling from the sofa, "I must take my leave of you, though I say, yours is very good tobacco. But it's too mild."
"Yes, it's too mild," returned his entertainer.
It's ridiculously mild," said Tom.
"Where's the door? Good night."
He had another odd dream of being taken by a waiter through a mist, which, after giving him some trouble and difficulty, resolved itself into the main street, in which he stood alone. He then walked home pretty easily, though not yet free from an impression of the presence and influence of his new friend, as if he were lounging somewhere in the air, in the same negligent attitude, regarding him with the same look. The whelp went home and went to bed. If he had had any sense of what he had done that night, and had been less of a whelp and more of a brother, he might have turned short on the road, might have gone down to the ill-smelling river that was dyed black, might have gone to bed in it for good and all, and have curtained his head forever with its filthy waters. Chapter 4. Men and Brothers.
"Oh, my friends, the downtrodden operatives of Coketown! Oh, my friends and fellow countrymen, the slaves of an iron-handed and a grinding despotism! Oh, my friends and fellow sufferers and fellow workmen and fellow men, I tell you that the hour is come when we must rally round one another as one united power, and crumble into the dust the oppressors that too long have battened upon the plunder of our families, upon the sweat of our brows, upon the labour of our hands, upon the strength of our sinews, upon the God-created glorious rights of humanity, and upon the holy and eternal privileges of brotherhood." "Good! Hear, hear, hear! Hurrah!"
and other cries arose in many voices from various parts of the densely crowded and suffocatingly close hall, in which the orator, perched on a stage, delivered himself of this and what other froth and fume he had in him. He had declaimed himself into a violent heat and was as hoarse as he was hot. By dint of roaring at the top of his voice under a flaring gaslight, clenching his fists, knitting his brows, setting his teeth and pounding with his arms, he had taken so much out of himself by this time that he was brought to a stop and called for a glass of water. As he stood there, trying to quench his fiery face with his drink of water, the comparison between the orator and the crowd of attentive faces turned towards him was extremely to his disadvantage. Judging him by nature's evidence, he was above the mass in very little but the stage on which he stood. In many great respects, he was essentially below them. He was not so honest, he was not so manly, he was not so good-humoured. He substituted cunning for their simplicity, and passion for their safe, solid sense. An ill-made, high-shouldered man, with lowering brows, and his features crushed into an habitually sour expression, he contrasted most unfavourably, even in his mongrel dress, with the great body of his hearers in their plain working clothes. Strange as it always is to consider any assembly in the act of submissively resigning itself to the dreariness of some complacent person, lord or commoner, whom three-fourths of it could, by no human means, raise out of the slough of inanity to their own intellectual level, it was particularly strange, and it was even particularly affecting, to see this crowd of earnest faces, whose honesty in the main no competent observer free from bias could doubt, so agitated by such a leader. "Good! Hear, hear! Hurrah!" The eagerness of both attention and intention exhibited in all the countenances made them a most impressive sight. There was no carelessness, no languor, no idle curiosity, none of the many shades of indifference to be seen in all other assemblies, visible for one moment there. That every man felt his condition to be somehow or other worse than it might be, that every man considered it incumbent on him to join the rest towards the making of it better, that every man felt his only hope to be in his allying himself to the comrades by whom he was surrounded, and that in this belief, right or wrong, unhappily wrong, then, the whole of that crowd were gravely, deeply, faithfully in earnest, must have been as plain to anyone who chose to see what was there as the bare beams of the roof and the whitened brick walls. Nor could any such spectator fail to know in his own breast that these men, through their very delusions, showed great qualities, susceptible of being turned to the happiest and best account, and that to pretend on the strength of sweeping axioms, howsoever cut and dried, that they went astray, wholly without cause and of their own irrational wills, was to pretend that there could be smoke without fire, death without birth, harvest without seed, anything or everything produced from nothing. The orator, having refreshed himself, wiped his corrugated forehead from left to right several times with his handkerchief folded into a pad, and concentrated all his revived forces in a sneer of great disdain and bitterness.
"But oh, my friends and brothers, oh, men and Englishmen, the downtrodden operatives of Coketown! What shall we say of that man, that working man, that I should find it necessary so to libel the glorious name, who being practically and well acquainted with the grievances and wrongs of you, the injured pith and marrow of this land, and having heard you with a noble and majestic unanimity that will make tyrants tremble, resolve for to subscribe to the funds of the United Aggregate Tribunal, and to abide by the injunctions issued by that body for your benefit, whatever they may be, what, I ask you, will you say of that working man, since such I must acknowledge him to be, who at such a time deserts his post and sells his flag? Who at such a time turns a traitor and a craven and a recreant? Who at such a time turns a traitor and a craven and a recreant? Who at such a time is not ashamed to make you the dastardly and humiliating avowal that he will hold himself aloof and will not be one of those associated in the gallant stand for freedom and for right?
The assembly was divided at this point. There were some groans and hisses, but the general sense of honour was much too strong for the condemnation of a man unheard.
"Be sure you are right, Slackbridge. Put him up. Let's hear him."
Such things were said on many sides. Finally, one strong voice called out,
"Is the man here? If the man's here, Slackbridge, let's hear the man himself instead of you."
Which was received with a round of applause. Slackbridge, the orator, looked about him with a withering smile, and holding out his right hand at arm's length, as the manner of all Slackbridges is, to still the thundering sea, waited until there was a profound silence.
"Oh, my friends and fellow men," said Slackbridge then, shaking his head with violent scorn, "I do not wonder that you, the prostrate sons of labour, are incredulous of the existence of such a man. But he who sold his birthright for a mess of pottage existed. And Judas Iscariot existed, and Castlereagh existed, and this man exists."
Here a brief press and confusion near the stage ended in the man himself standing at the orator's side before the concourse. He was pale and a little moved in the face. His lips especially showed it. But he stood quiet, with his left hand at his chin, waiting to be heard. There was a chairman to regulate the proceedings, and this functionary now took the case into his own hands.
"My friends," said he, "by virtue of my office as your president, I ask of our friend Slackbridge, who may be a little over hetter in this business, to take his seat whilst this man, Stephen Blackpool, is here. You all know this man, Stephen Blackpool. You know him along of his misfortunes and his good name."
With that, the chairman shook him frankly by the hand and sat down again. Slackbridge likewise sat down, wiping his hot forehead, always from left to right, and never the reverse way. "My friends," Stephen began, in the midst of a dead calm, "I've heard what's been spoken of me, and it's likely that I shan't mend it, but I'd liefer you'd hearn the truth concerning my son from my lips than from any other man's, though I never could speak before so many without being moidered and muddled." Slackbridge shook his head as if he would shake it off in his bitterness. "I'm the one single hand in Bounderby's mill, of all the men there, as don't come in with the proposed regulations. I cannot come in with them.
My friends, I doubt they're doing you any good. Liquor they'll do you hurt.
Slackbridge laughed, folded his arms and frowned sarcastically.
But it ain't so much for that as I stands out. If that were all, I'd come in with the rest. But I have my reasons, mine, you see, for being hindered. Not only now, but always, always, lifelong.
Slackbridge jumped up and stood beside him, gnashing and tearing.
Oh, my friends, what but this did I tell you? Oh, my fellow countrymen, what warning but this did I give you? And how shows this recreant conduct in a man on whom unequal laws are known to have fallen heavy? Oh, you Englishmen, I ask you, how does this subornation show in one of yourselves who is thus consenting to his own undoing and to yours and to your children's and your children's children's?
There was some applause and some crying of shame upon the man, but the greater part of the audience were quiet. They looked at Stephen's worn face, rendered more pathetic by the homely emotions it evinced, and in the kindness of their nature they were more sorry than indignant.
"'Tis this delegate's trade for to speak,' said Stephen, "'and he's paid for it, and he knows his work. Let him keep to it. Let him give no heed to what I've happened to bear. That's not for him. That's for nobody but me.'
There was a propriety, not to say a dignity, in these words, that made the hearers yet more quiet and attentive. The same strong voice called out,
"'Slackbridge, let the man be heen, and hold thy tongue!'
Then the place was wonderfully still.
"'My brothers,' said Stephen, whose low voice was distinctly heard, "'and my fellow workmen, for that you are to me, though not as I knows unto this delegate here. I have but a word to send, and I could send no more if I was to speak till strike day. I know well all what's afore me. I know well that you all resolve to have no more ado with a man who is not with you in this matter. I know well that if I was a lion perished in the road, you'd feel it right to pass me by as a foreigner and a stranger. What I've getten, I mun make the best on.
Stephen Blackpool, said the chairman, rising. Think on it again. Think on it once again, lad, afore thou'rt shunned by all thy old friends.
There was a universal murmur to the same effect, though no man articulated a word. Every eye was fixed on Stephen's face. To repent of his determination would be to take a load from all their minds. He looked around him, and knew that it was so. Not a grain of anger with them was in his heart. He knew them far below their surface weaknesses and misconceptions, as no one but their fellow labourer could.
"'I have thought on it, above a bit, sir. I simply cannot come in. I mun go the way as lays before me. I mun take my leave of all here.'
He made a sort of reverence to them by holding up his arms, and stood for the moment in that attitude, not speaking, until they slowly dropped at his sides.
"'Money's the pleasant word as some here has spoken with me. Money's the face I see here, as I first seen when I were young and lighter hearted than now. I have never had no fracture force in ever I were born with any of my like. God knows I had no now that's of my making. You'll call me traitor and that. You, I mean to say," addressing Slackbridge, "but 'tis easier to call than make out. So, let be."
He had moved away a pace or two to come down from the platform, when he remembered something he had not said and returned again.
"Haply," he said, turning his furrowed face slowly about, that he might, as it were, individually address the whole audience, those both near and distant. "Haply, when this question has been taken up and discussed, there'll be a threat to turn out if I'm let to work among you. I hope I shall die ere ever such a time comes, and I shall work solitary among you unless it comes. Truly, I mun do it, my friends, not to brave you, but to live. I've no but work to live by, and wherever can I go? I, who have worked sin our no height at all in Corktown here. I make no complaints of being turned to the wall, or being outcasting and overlooking for this time forward, but I hope I shall be let to work. If there is any right for me at all, my friends, I think 'tis that."
Not a word was spoken. Not a sound was audible in the building, but the slight rustle of men moving a little apart all along the centre of the room, to open a means of passing out to the man with whom they had all bound themselves to renounce companionship.
looking at no one, and going his way with a lowly steadiness upon him that asserted nothing and sought nothing, old Stephen, with all his troubles on his head, left the scene. Then Slackbridge, who had kept his oratorical arm extended during the going out, as if he were repressing with infinite solicitude and by a wonderful moral power the vehement passions of the multitude, applied himself to raising their spirits. Had not the Roman Brutus, O my British countrymen, condemned his son to death? And had not the Spartan mothers, O my soon-to-be victorious friends, driven their flying children on the points of their enemies' swords? Then was it not the sacred duty of the men of Coketown, with forefathers before them, an admiring world in company with them, and a posterity to come after them, to hurl out traitors from the tents they had pitched in a sacred and a godlike cause? The winds of heaven answered yes, and bore yes, east, west, north, and south, and consequently three cheers for the United Aggregate Tribunal. Slackbridge acted as fugleman and gave the time. The multitude of doubtful faces, a little conscience-stricken, brightened at the sound and took it up. Private feeling must yield to the common cause. Hurrah! The roof yet vibrated with the cheering when the assembly dispersed. Thus easily did Stephen Blackpool fall into the loneliest of lives, the life of solitude among a familiar crowd. The stranger in the land who looks into 10,000 faces for some answering look and never finds it is in cheering society as compared with him who passes 10 averted faces daily that were once the countenances of friends. Such experience was to be Stephen's now in every waking moment of his life, at his work, on his way to it and from it, at his door, at his window, everywhere. By general consent, they even avoided that side of the street on which he habitually walked, and left it, of all the working men, to him only. He had been for many years a quiet, silent man, associating but little with other men, and used to companionship with his own thoughts. He had been for many years a quiet, silent man, associating but little with other men, and used to companionship with his own thoughts. He had never known before the strength of the want in his heart, for the frequent recognition of a nod, a look, a word, or the immense amount of relief that had been poured into it by drops through such small means. It was even harder than he could have believed possible to separate in his own conscience his abandonment by all his fellows from a baseless sense of shame and disgrace. The first 4 days of his endurance were days so long and heavy that he began to be appalled by the prospect before him. Not only did he see no Rachel all the time, but he avoided every chance of seeing her, for although he knew that the prohibition did not yet formally extend to the women working in the factories, he found that some of them with whom he was acquainted were changed to him, and he feared to try others, and dreaded that Rachel might be even singled out from the rest if she were seen in his company. So he had been quite alone during the 4 days, and had spoken to no one, when, as he was leaving his work at night, a young man of a very light complexion accosted him in the street.
"Your name's Blackpool, ain't it?" said the young man.
Stephen coloured to find himself with his hat in his hand, in his gratitude for being spoken to, or in the suddenness of it, or both. He made a feint of adjusting the lining, and said,
"Yes." "You are the hand they have sent to Coventry, I mean,"
said Bitzer, the very light young man in question. Stephen answered, "Yes," again.
"I suppose so, from all their appearing to keep away from you. Mr. Bounderby wants to speak to you. You know his house, don't you?"
Stephen said, "Yes," again.
"Then go straight up there, will you?" said Bitzer. "You're expected, and I've only to tell the servant it's you. I belong to the bank, so if you go straight up without me, I was sent to fetch you. You'll save me a walk."
Stephen, whose way had been in the contrary direction, turned about and betook himself as in duty bound to the red brick castle of the giant Bounderby. Chapter 5. Men and Masters.
"Well, Stephen," said Bounderby in his windy manner, "what's this I hear? What have these pests of the earth been doing to you? Come in and speak up."
It was into the drawing-room that he was thus bidden. A tea-table was set out,
and Mr. Bounderby's young wife and her brother and a great gentleman from London were present, to whom Stephen made his obeisance, closing the door and standing near it with his hat in his hand.
"This is the man I was telling you about, Harthouse," said Mr. Bounderby.
The gentleman he addressed, who was talking to Mrs. Bounderby on the sofa, got up, saying in an indolent way, "Oh, really?" and dawdled to the hearthrug where Mr. Bounderby stood.
"Now," said Bounderby, "speak up."
After the 4 days he had passed, this address fell rudely and discordantly on Stephen's ear. Besides being a rough handling of his wounded mind, it seemed to assume that he really was the self-interested deserter he had been called.
"What were it, sir," said Stephen, "as you were pleased to want with me?"
"Why, I have told you," returned Bounderby. "Speak up like a man, since you are a man, and tell us about yourself and this combination."
"With your pardon, sir," said Stephen Blackpool, "I have nought to say about it."
Mr. Bounderby, who was always more or less like a wind, finding something in his way here, began to blow at it directly.
"Now look here, Harthouse," said he. "Here's a specimen of him. When this man was here once before, I warned this man against the mischievous strangers who are always about, and who ought to be hanged wherever they are found, and I told this man he was going in the wrong direction. Now, would you believe it, that although they have put this mark upon him, he is such a slave to them still that he's afraid to open his lips about him?"
"I said as I had nought to send, sir, not as I was fearful of opening my lips."
"You said? Ah, I know what you've said. More than that, I know what you mean, you see. Not always the same thing, by the Lord Harry. Quite different things. You had better tell us at once that that fellow Slackbridge is not in the town, stirring up the people to mutiny, and that he is not a regular qualified leader of the people. That is a most confounded scoundrel. You had better tell us so at once. You can't deceive me."
"You want to tell us so? Why don't you?"
"I'm as sorry as you, sir, when the people's leaders is bad," said Stephen, shaking his head. "They takes such as offers. Haply 'tisna the smallest of their misfortunes when they can get no better."
The wind began to get boisterous.
"Now, you'll think this pretty well, Harthouse," said Mr. Bounderby. "You'll think this tolerably strong. You'll say, upon my soul, this is a tidy specimen of what my friends have to deal with. But this is nothing, sir.
You shall hear me ask this man a question. Pray, Mr. Blackpool,"
wind springing up very fast,
"may I take the liberty of asking you how it happens that you refuse to be in this combination?"
"How it happens?"
"Aye," said Mr. Bounderby, with his thumbs in the arms of his coat and jerking his head and shutting his eyes in confidence with the opposite wall. "How it happens?"
"I'd liefer not come to it, sir, but since you put the question, and not wanting to be ill-mannered, I'll answer. I've passed a promise."
"Not to me, you know," said Bounderby, gusty weather with deceitful calms, one now prevailing.
"Oh, no, sir, not to you."
"As for me, any consideration for me has had just nothing at all to do with it," said Bounderby, still in confidence with the wall. "If only Josiah Bounderby of Coketown had been in question, you would have joined and made no bones about it."
"Why, yes, sir, 'tis true."
"Though he knows," said Mr. Bounderby, now blowing a gale, "that there are a set of rascals and rebels whom transportation is too good for. Now, Mr. Harthouse, you've been knocking about in the world some time. Did you ever meet with anything like that man out of this blessed country?"
And Mr. Bounderby pointed him out for inspection with an angry finger.
"Nay, ma'am," said Stephen Blackpool, staunchly protesting against the words that had been used, and instinctively addressing himself to Louisa after glancing at her face. "Not rebels, nor yet rascals. Nought of the kind, ma'am, nought of the kind. They've not done me a kindness, ma'am, as I know and feel, but there's not a dozen men among them, ma'am. A dozen, not six, but what believes as he has done his duty by the rest and by himself. God forbid, as I, that have known and had an experience of these men all my life, that have eaten and drunken with them, and sitting with them, and toiling with them, and loving them, should fail for to stand by him with the truth. Let them have done to me what they may."
He spoke with the rugged earnestness of his place and character, deepened perhaps by a proud consciousness that he was faithful to his class, under all their mistrust. But he fully remembered where he was, and did not even raise his voice.
"No, ma'am, no, they're true to one another. Faithful to one another, affectionate to one another, e'en to death. be poor among them, sick among them, grieve among them for any of the many causes that carries grief to the poor man's door, and they'll be tender with you, gentle with you, comfortable with you, Christian with you. Be sure of that, ma'am. They'd be riven to bits ere ever they'd be different.
In short, said Mr. Bounderby, it's because they are so full of virtues that they have turned you adrift. Go through with it while you're about it. Out with it.
How 'tis, ma'am, resumed Stephen, appearing still to find his natural refuge in Louisa's face, that what is best in us folk seems to turn us most to trouble and misfortune and mistake, I dunno, but 'tis so. I know 'tis, as I know the heavens is over me ahind the smoke. We're patient, too, and wants in general to do right. I canna think the fault is all with us.
Now, my friend, said Mr. Bounderby, whom he could not have exasperated more, quite unconscious of it though he was, than by seeming to appeal to anyone else. If you will favour me with your attention for half a minute, I should like to have a word or two with you. You said just now that you had nothing to tell us about this business. You are quite sure of that before we go any further?
Sir, I'm sure on it.
Here's a gentleman from London present. Mr. Bounderby made a backhanded point at Mr. James Harthouse with his thumb. A Parliament gentleman. I should like him to hear a short bit of dialogue between you and me, instead of taking the substance of it, for I know precious well beforehand what it will be, nobody knows better than I do, take notice, instead of receiving it on trust from my mouth.
Stephen bent his head to the gentleman from London, and showed a rather more troubled mind than usual. He turned his eyes involuntarily to his former refuge, but at a look from that quarter, expressive though instantaneous, he settled them on Mr. Bounderby's face.
Now, what do you complain of? Asked Mr. Bounderby.
I have not come here, sir, Stephen reminded him, to complain. I come for that I was sent for.
What, repeated Mr. Bounderby, folding his arms, do you people in a general way complain of?
Stephen looked at him with some little irresolution for a moment, and then seemed to make up his mind. Sir, I were never good at shewing of it, though I've had my share in feeling of it. Indeed, we are in a muddle, sir. Look round town, so rich as 'tis, and see the numbers of people that has been brought into being here for to weave and to card and to piece out a living, all the same one way somehow's twixt their cradles and their graves. Look how we live, and where we live, and in what numbers, and by what chances, and with what sameness, and look how the mills is always a-going, and how they never works us no nigher to any distant object, excepting always death. Look how you considers of us, and writes of us, and talks of us, and goes up with your deputations to secretaries of state about us, and how you are always right, and how we are always wrong, and never had no reason in us sin' ever we were born. Look how this have grown and grown, sir, bigger and bigger, broader and broader, harder and harder from year to year, from generation unto generation. Who can look on it, sir, and fairly tell a man 'tis not a muddle?
Of course, said Mr. Bounderby. Now perhaps you'll let the gentleman know how you would set this muddle, as you're so fond of calling it, to rights.
I don't know, sir. I canna be expecting to it. 'Tis not me as should be looking for to that, sir. 'Tis them as is put over me, and over all the rest of us. What do they take upon themselves, sir, if not to do it?
I'll tell you something towards it, at any rate, returned Mr. Bounderby. We will make an example of half a dozen slack bridges. We'll indict the blackguards for felony, and get them shipped off to penal settlements.
Stephen gravely shook his head.
Don't tell me we won't, ma'am, said Mr. Bounderby, by this time blowing a hurricane, because we will, I tell you.
Sir, returned Stephen, with the quiet confidence of absolute certainty. If you was to take 100 slack bridges, all as there is, and all the number 10 times told, and was to sew them up in separate sacks, and sink them in the deepest ocean as were made ere ever dry land come to be, you'd leave the muddle just where 'tis. Mischievous strangers, said Stephen, with an anxious smile. When have we not heard, I'm sure, sin' ever we can call to mind are the mischievous strangers? 'Tis not by them the trouble's made, sir. 'Tis not with them it commences. I have no favour for them. I have no reason to favour them. But 'tis hopeless and useless to dream of taking them from their trade instead of taking their trade from them. All that's now about me in this room were here afore I come, and 'twill be here when I am gone. Put that clock aboard a ship and pack it off to Norfolk Island, and the time will go on just the same. So 'tis with Slackbridge every bit.
Reverting for a moment to his former refuge, he observed a cautionary movement of her eyes towards the door. Stepping back, he put his hand upon the lock. But he had not spoken out of his own will and desire, and he felt it in his heart a noble return for his late injurious treatment, to be faithful to the last to those who had repudiated him. He stayed to finish what was in his mind.
"Sir, I cannot with my little learning and my common weir tell the gentleman what will better all this, though some working men of this town could, above my powers, but I can tell him what I know will never do it. The strong hand will never do it. Victory and triumph will never do it. Agreeing for to make one side unnaturally always and forever right, and t'other side unnaturally always and forever wrong, will never, never do it. Nor yet letting alone will never do it. Let thousands upon thousands alone, all leading the like lives and all falling into the like muddle, and they will be as one, and you will be as another, with a black, unpassable world betwixt you, just as long or short a time as such like misery can last. Not drawing nigh to folk, with kindness and patience and cheery ways that so draws nigh to one another in the many troubles, and so cherishes one another in their distresses with what they need themselves, like I humbly believe, as no people the gentleman has seen in all his travels can beat, will never do it till the sun turns to ice. Most of all, rating them as so much power, and regulating them as if they were figures in a sum, or machines, without loves and likings, without memories and inclinations, without souls to weary and souls to hope. When all goes quiet, dragging on with them as if they'd nought of the kind, and when all goes unquiet, reproaching them for their want of such humanly feelings in their dealings with you, this will never do it, sir, till God's work is unmade.
Stephen stood with the open door in his hand, waiting to know if anything more were expected of him.
"Just stop a moment," said Mr. Bounderby, excessively red in the face. "I told you, the last time you were here with a grievance, that you had better turn about and come out of that. And I also told you, if you remember, that I was up to the gold spoon lookout."
I were not up to it myself, sir, I do assure you."
"Now, it's clear to me," said Mr. Bounderby, "that you are one of those chaps who have always got a grievance, and you go about sowing it and raising crops. That's the business of your life, my friend."
Stephen shook his head, mutely protesting that indeed he had other business to do for his life.
"You are such a waspish, raspish, ill-conditioned chap, you see," said Mr. Bounderby, "that even your own union, the men who know you best, will have nothing to do with you. I never thought those fellows could be right in anything, but I tell you what, I so far go along with them for a novelty that I'll have nothing to do with you either."
Stephen raised his eyes quickly to his face.
"You can finish off what you're at," said Mr. Bounderby with a meaning nod, "and then go elsewhere."
"Sir, you know well," said Stephen expressively, "that if I cannot get work with you, I cannot get it elsewhere."
The reply was,
"What I know, and what you know, you know. I have no more to say about it."
Stephen glanced at Louisa again, but her eyes were raised to his no more. Therefore, with a sigh, and saying, barely above his breath, "Heaven help us all in this world," he departed.
Chapter 6. Fading Away. It was falling dark when Stephen came out of Mr. Bounderby's house. The shadows of night had gathered so fast that he did not look about him when he closed the door, but plodded straight along the street. Nothing was further from his thoughts than the curious old woman he had encountered on his previous visit to the same house, when he heard a step behind him that he knew, and turning, saw her in Rachel's company. He saw Rachel first, as he had heard her only.
"Oh, Rachel, my dear. Missus, thou with her?"
"Well, now you are surprised, to be sure, and with reason, I must say," the old woman returned. "Here I am again, you see."
"But how with Rachel?" said Stephen, falling into their step, walking between them and looking from the one to the other.
"Why, I come to be with this good lass pretty much as I came to be with you," said the old woman, cheerfully taking the reply upon herself. "My visiting time is later this year than usual, for I've been rather troubled with shortness of breath, and so put it off till the weather was fine and warm. For the same reason I don't make all my journey in one day, but divide it into 2 days, and get a bed tonight at the Traveller's Coffee House down by the railroad, a nice clean house, and go back parliamentary at 6 in the morning. Well, but what has this to do with this good lass, says you? I'm going to tell you. I've heard of Mr. Bounderby being married. I read it in the paper, where it looked grand. Oh, it looked fine.
The old woman dwelt on it with a strange enthusiasm.
And I want to see his wife. I've never seen her yet. Now, if you'll believe me, she hasn't come out of that house since noon today. So, not to give her up too easily, I was waiting about a little last bit more, when I passed close to this good lass 2 or 3 times, and her face being so friendly, I spoke to her, and she spoke to me. There, said the old woman to Stephen. You can make all the rest out for yourself now. A deal shorter than I can, I dare say.
Once again, Stephen had to conquer an instinctive propensity to dislike this old woman, though her manner was as honest and simple as a manner possibly could be. With a gentleness that was as natural to him as he knew it to be to Rachel, he pursued the subject that interested her in her old age.
"Well, missus," said he, "I have seen the lady, and she were young and handsome, with fine, dark, thinking eyes, and a still way, Rachel, as I have never seen the like on."
"Young and handsome, yes," cried the old woman, quite delighted. "As bonny as a rose, and what a happy wife."
"Aye, missus, I suppose she be," said Stephen, but with a doubtful glance at Rachel.
"Suppose she be? She must be. She's your master's wife," returned the old woman.
Stephen nodded assent.
"Though, as to master," said he, glancing again at Rachel, "not master any more. That's all ending twixt him and me."
"Have you left his work, Stephen?"
asked Rachel, anxiously and quickly.
"Why, Rachel," he replied, "whether I have left in his work or whether his work have left in me comes to the same. His work and me are parted. 'Tis as well so. Better, I were thinking, when you come up with me. It would have brought in trouble upon trouble if I'd stayed there. Haply 'tis a kindness to money that I go. Haply 'tis a kindness to myself. Anyways, it mun be done. I mun turn my face from Coketown for the time, and seek a fortune, dear, by beginning fresh."
"Where will you go, Stephen?"
"I dunno tonight," said he, lifting off his hat and smoothing his thin hair with the flat of his hand. "But I'm not going tonight, Rachel, nor yet tomorrow. 'Tain't easy overmuch to know where to turn, but a good heart will come to me."
Herein, too, the sense of even thinking unselfishly aided him. Before he had so much as closed Mr. Bounderby's door, he had reflected that at least his being obliged to go away was good for her, as it would save her from the chance of being brought into question for not withdrawing from him. Though it would cost him a hard pang to leave her, and though he could think of no similar place in which his condemnation would not pursue him, perhaps it was almost a relief to be forced away from the endurance of the last 4 days, even to unknown difficulties and distresses. So he said with truth,
"I'm more leetsome, Rachel, under it than I couldn't have believed."
It was not her part to make his burden heavier. She answered with her comforting smile, and the three walked on together. Age, especially when it strives to be self-reliant and cheerful, finds much consideration among the poor. The old woman was so decent and contented, and made so light of her infirmities, though they had increased upon her since her former interview with Stephen, that they both took an interest in her. She was too sprightly to allow of their walking at a slow pace on her account, but she was very grateful to be talked to, and very willing to talk to any extent. So, when they came to their part of the town, she was more brisk and vivacious than ever.
"Come to my poor place, missus," said Stephen, "and take a cup of tea. Rachel will come then, and afterwards I'll see thee safe to thy traveller's lodging. It may be long, Rachel, ere I ever have the chance of thy company again."
They complied, and the three went on to the house where he lodged. When they turned into a narrow street, Stephen glanced at his window with a dread that always haunted his desolate home. But it was open as he had left it, and no one was there. The evil spirit of his life had flitted away again months ago, and he had heard no more of her since. The only evidence of her last return now with the scantier movables in his room, and the greyer hair upon his head. He lighted a candle, set out his little tea-board, got hot water from below, and brought in small portions of tea and sugar, a loaf and some butter from the nearest shop. The bread was new and crusty, the butter fresh, and the sugar lump, of course, in fulfilment of the standard testimony of the Coketown magnates that these people lived like princes, sir. Rachel made the tea, so large a party necessitated the borrowing of a cup, and the visitor enjoyed it mightily. It was the first glimpse of sociality the host had had for many days. He, too, with the world a wide heath before him, enjoyed the meal, again in corroboration of the magnates, as exemplifying the utter want of calculation on the part of these people, sir.
"I had never thought yet, Mrs.," said Stephen, "of asking thy name."
The old lady announced herself as Mrs. Pegler.
"A widow, I think," said Stephen.
"Oh, many long years."
Mrs. Pegler's husband, one of the best on record, was already dead by Mrs. Pegler's calculation when Stephen was born.
"'Twere a bad job, too, to lose so good a one," said Stephen. "Only children?"
Mrs. Pegler's cup, rattling against her saucer as she held it, denoted some nervousness on her part.
"No," she said, "not now, not now." "Dead, Stephen," Rachel softly hinted.
"I'm sorry I've spoken on it," said Stephen. "I ought to have it in my mind as I might touch a sore place. I blame myself."
While he excused himself, the old lady's cup rattled more and more.
"I had a son," she said, curiously distressed, and not by any of the usual appearances of sorrow. "And he did well, wonderfully well. But he is not to be spoken of, if you please. He is..."
Putting down her cup, she moved her hands as if she would have added by her action, "dead." Then she said aloud,
"I have lost him."
Stephen had not yet got the better of his having given the old lady pain, when his landlady came stumbling up the narrow stairs, and, calling him to the door, whispered in his ear. Mrs. Pegler was by no means deaf, for she caught a word as it was uttered.
"Bounderby," she cried,
in a suppressed voice, starting up from the table.
"Oh, hide me. Don't let me be seen for the world. Don't let him come up until I've got away. Pray, pray."
She trembled and was excessively agitated, getting behind Rachel when Rachel tried to reassure her, and not seeming to know what she was about.
"But hearken, Mrs., hearken," said Stephen, astonished. "'Tisn't Mr. Bounderby, 'tis his wife. You're not fearful of her. You was here go mad about her but an hour sin."
"But are you sure it's the lady and not the gentleman?" she asked, still trembling.
"Certain sure."
"Well then, pray don't speak to me, nor yet take any notice of me," said the old woman. "Let me be quite to myself in this corner."
Stephen nodded, looking to Rachel for an explanation which she was quite unable to give him, took the candle, went downstairs, and in a few moments returned, lighting Louisa into the room. She was followed by the whelp. Rachel had risen and stood apart with her shawl and bonnet in her hand, when Stephen, himself proudly astonished by this visit, put the candle on the table. Then he, too, stood with his doubled hand upon the table near it, waiting to be addressed. For the first time in her life, Louisa had come into one of the dwellings of the Coketown hands. For the first time in her life, she was face to face with anything like individuality in connection with them. She knew of their existence by hundreds and by thousands. She knew what results in work a given number of them would produce in a given space of time. She knew them in crowds, passing to and from their nests like ants or beetles, but she knew from her reading infinitely more of the ways of toiling insects than of these toiling men and women. Something to be worked so much and paid so much, and there ended. Something to be infallibly settled by laws of supply and demand. Something that blundered against those laws and floundered into difficulty. Something that was a little pinched when wheat was dear and overate itself when wheat was cheap. Something that increased at such a rate of percentage and yielded such another percentage of crime and such another percentage of pauperism. Something wholesale of which vast fortunes were made. Something that occasionally rose like a sea and did some harm and waste, chiefly to itself, and fell again.
This she knew the Coketown hands to be, but she had scarcely thought more of separating them into units than of separating the sea itself into its component drops. She stood for some moments, looking round the room. From the few chairs, the few books, the common prints and the bed, she glanced to the two women and to Stephen.
"I have come to speak to you in consequence of what passed just now. I should like to be serviceable to you, if you will let me. Is this your wife?"
Rachel raised her eyes, and they sufficiently answered no, and dropped again.
"I remember," said Louisa, reddening at her mistake. "I recollect now to have heard your domestic misfortunes spoken of, though I was not attending to the particulars at the time. It was not my meaning to ask a question that would give pain to anyone here. If I should ask any other question that may happen to have that result, give me credit, if you please, for being in ignorance how to speak to you as I ought."
As Stephen had but a little while ago instinctively addressed himself to her, so she now instinctively addressed herself to Rachel. Her manner was short and abrupt, yet faltering and timid.
"He has told you what has passed between himself and my husband. You would be his first resource, I think."
"I have heard the end of it, young lady," said Rachel. "Did I understand that being rejected by one employer, he would probably be rejected by all? I thought he said as much." "The chances are very small, young lady, next to nothing for a man who gets a bad name among 'em." "What shall I understand that you mean by a bad name?" "The name of being troublesome." "Then by the prejudices of his own class and by the prejudices of the other, he is sacrificed alike. Are the two so deeply separated in this town that there is no place whatever for an honest workman between them?"
Rachel shook her head in silence.
"He fell into suspicion," said Louisa, "with his fellow weavers, because he had made a promise not to be one of them. I think it must have been to you that he made that promise. Might I ask you why he made it?"
Rachel burst into tears.
"I didn't seek it of him, poor lad. I prayed him to avoid trouble for his own good, little thinking he'd come to it through me. But I know he'd die 100 deaths ere ever he'd break his word. I know that of him well."
Stephen had remained quietly attentive in his usual thoughtful attitude, with his hand at his chin. He now spoke in a voice rather less steady than usual.
"No one excepting myself can ever know what honour and what love and respect I bear to Rachel, or with what cause. When I passed that promise, I told her true she were the angel of my life. 'Twere a solemn promise. 'Tis gone from me forever."
Louisa turned her head to him and bent it with a deference that was new in her. She looked from him to Rachel, and her features softened.
"What will you do?" she asked him, and her voice had softened too.
"Well, ma'am," said Stephen, making the best of it with a smile, "when I have finished off, I mun quit this part and try another. Fortunate or misfortunate, a man can but try. There's no to be done without trying, except laying down and dying."
"How will you travel?"
"Afoot, my kind lady, afoot."
Louisa coloured, and a purse appeared in her hand. The rustling of a banknote was audible, and she unfolded one and laid it on the table.
"Rachel, will you tell him, for you know how, without offence, that this is freely his to help him on his way? Will you entreat him to take it?"
"I canna do that, young lady," she answered, turning her head aside. "Bless you for thinking of the poor lad with such tenderness, but 'tis for him to know his heart and what is right according to it."
Louisa looked in part incredulous, in part frightened, in part overcome with quick sympathy, when this man of so much self-command, who had been so plain and steady through the late interview, lost his composure in a moment, and now stood with his hand before his face. She stretched out hers as if she would have touched him, then checked herself and remained still.
"Not e'en Rachel," said Stephen, when he stood again with his face uncovered, "could make such a kind offering by only words kinder. To show that I'm not a man without reason and gratitude, I'll take £2. I'll borrow it for to pay it back. "'Twill be the sweetest work as ever I have done "'that puts it in my power "'to acknowledge once more my lasting thankfulness "'for this present action.' "'She was fain to take up the note again "'and to substitute the much smaller sum he had named. "'He was neither courtly nor handsome "'nor picturesque in any respect, "'and yet his manner of accepting it "'and of expressing his thanks without more words "'had a grace in it.' That Lord Chesterfield could not have taught his son in a century. Tom had sat upon the bed, swinging one leg and sucking his walking stick with sufficient unconcern until the visit had attained this stage. Seeing his sister ready to depart, he got up rather hurriedly and put in a word.
"Just wait a moment, Lou. Before we go, I should like to speak to him a moment. Something comes into my head. If you'll step out on the stairs, Blackpool, I'll mention it. Never mind a light, man."
Tom was remarkably impatient of his moving towards the cupboard to get one.
"I don't want a light."
Stephen followed him out, and Tom closed the room door and held the lock in his hand.
"I say," he whispered, "I think I can do you a good turn. Don't ask me what it is, because it may not come to anything, but there's no harm in my trying."
His breath fell like a flame of fire on Stephen's ear, it was so hot.
"That was our light porter at the bank," said Tom, "who brought you the message tonight. I call him our light porter because I belong to the bank too."
Stephen thought what a hurry he is in. He spoke so confusedly.
"Well," said Tom, "now look here. When are you off?"
"Today's Monday," replied Stephen, considering.
"Why, sir, Friday or Saturday, nigh about?"
"Friday or Saturday," said Tom. "Now look here. I'm not sure that I can do you the good turn I want to do you. That's my sister, you know, in your room. But I may be able to, and if I should not be able to, there's no harm done. So, I tell you what, you'll know our light porter again?"
"Yes, sure," said Stephen.
"Very well," returned Tom. "When you leave work of a night, between this and your going away, just hang about the bank an hour or so, will you? Don't take on as if you meant anything, if he should see you hanging about there, because I shan't put him up to speak to you unless I find I can do you the service I want to do you. In that case, he'll have a note or a message for you, but not else. Now look here, you're sure you understand?" He had wormed a finger in the darkness through a buttonhole of Stephen's coat and was screwing that corner of the garment tight up, round and round, in an extraordinary manner.
"I understand, sir," said Stephen.
"Now look here," repeated Tom. "Be sure you don't make any mistake, then, and don't forget. I shall tell my sister as we go home what I have in view, and she'll approve, I know. Now look here, you're all right, are you? You understand all about it? Very well, then.
Come along, Lou."
He pushed the door open as he called to her, but did not return into the room or wait to be lighted down the narrow stairs. He was at the bottom when she began to descend and was in the street before she could take his arm. Mrs. Pegler remained in her corner until the brother and sister were gone and until Stephen came back with the candle in his hand. She was in a state of inexpressible admiration of Mrs. Bounderby, and like an unaccountable old woman, wept because she was such a pretty dear. Yet Mrs. Pegler was so flurried lest the object of her admiration should return by chance, or anybody else should come, that her cheerfulness was ended for that night. It was late, too, to people who rose early and worked hard. Therefore the party broke up, and Stephen and Rachel escorted their mysterious acquaintance to the door of the Traveller's Coffee House, where they parted from her. They walked back together to the corner of the street where Rachel lived, and as they drew nearer and nearer to it, silence crept upon them. When they came to the dark corner where their unfrequent meetings always ended, they stopped, still silent, as if both were afraid to speak.
"I shall strive to see thee again, Rachel, afore I go. But if not..."
"Thou wilt not, Stephen, I know. 'Tis better that we make up our minds to be open with one another.
Thou art always right. 'Tis bolder and better.
I have been thinking then, Rachel, that as 'tis but a day or two that remains, 'twere better for thee, my dear, not to be seen with me. Might bring thee into trouble for no good. 'Tis not for that, Stephen, that I mind. But thou knowest our old agreement, 'tis for that. Well, well, said he, 'tis better onyways.